88, the low 65. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 5th, 2012, here at WILL AM 580. The eyes and ears of the world are tuned into London, England this week and next week for the Olympics, which run every 4 years. In the eyes, or at least the ears, of East Central Illinois, and thanks to the internet, much of the rest of the world will be tuned in right now to Dave Zirin, one of America's leading sports writers. We'll be talking about the Olympics. We'll be talking about the politics of sport for the full hour today on Media Matters. I do hope you'll join us. But before we go to our guest, let's go to NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. There's been a shooting at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. This town is about 12 miles south of Milwaukee on Lake Michigan. It is unclear how many people are shot or if anyone has died, but police in Oak Creek have cordoned off roadways leading to the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, and fire crews and ambulances are on the scene. People may still be inside. For the second day in a row, authorities evacuated an entire Oklahoma town because of fire. Kurt Gwartney of member station KGOU says at least 10 wildfires are burning in the state.
The 600 residents of Glencoe, Oklahoma, were forced to abandon their community as a wildland fire pushed into the town, burning structures and closing roads in the north-central part of the state. That fire is one of many fueled by drought-parched vegetation, high temperatures near 110 degrees, and shifting winds. Another fire in Creek County near Tulsa is being called the largest fire ever for that area. Residents of Luther, a suburb north of Oklahoma City, are being allowed in their neighborhoods for the first time since Friday, when a fire that may have been deliberately set burned 45 homes. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Gwartney in Oklahoma City.
NPR has confirmed prosecutors and the alleged Tucson mass shooter, Jared Lee Loughner, are working out a plea deal. Loughner is charged with killing 6 people and wounding 13 others, including then-Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords in January 2011. The arrangement calls for Loughner to plead guilty in exchange for a life prison sentence. The International Badminton Federation says it has found no evidence that coaches and other team officials were involved in a match-throwing scandal at the Olympics. 8 players got booted from the games last week. From London, NPR's Howard Berkus reports Federation officials are vague about any additional action.
Leaders of the Badminton World Federation say they want to get beyond the Olympics before considering changes in the match system that prompted deliberate attempts to lose by 4 women's doubles teams. All 8 athletes were disqualified from the Olympics, including the reigning world doubles champions. Thomas Lund, the foundation's chief operating officer, says the group wants to look forward, not back. So it's not clear whether the federation will continue to investigate allegations that players were told by coaches or team officials to throw their matches after already qualifying for advanced rounds. Deliberate losses enable the athletes to essentially select more desirable opponents. Howard Berkus, NPR News, London.
Among the latest results from the Olympic Games today in London, Americans Venus and Serena Williams captured the gold medal in the women's doubles tennis final. They faced a team from the Czech Republic, which took the silver medal. Yesterday, American brothers Bob and Mike Bryan captured the gold medal in men's doubles tennis, and Serena Williams won the women's singles final, defeating Maria Sharapova to claim the gold. You're listening to NPR News. The wife of Illinois Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. says her husband has been completely debilitated by depression. But NPR's Allison Keyes tells us she is expecting him to return to work.
Alderman Sandy Jackson told the Chicago Sun-Times that doctors at the Mayo Clinic are trying to find out if his depression is connected to weight loss surgery and that his body was just worn out. Jackson says her husband collapsed at their Washington, D.C. home June 10th, and they've kept him in what she calls a news blackout since then. Jackson denies rumors that the congressman was receiving help with alcohol or drug addiction. She says he's focused on returning to work, and he remains on the ballot in Illinois. The timing of Jackson's medical leave has raised questions, partly partly because he faces an ethics investigation in the U.S. House connected to imprisoned former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Allison Keyes, NPR News.
Late tonight, NASA's new Mars probe is scheduled to descend to the surface of the red planet. The rover, dubbed Curiosity, is a fully equipped lab designed to investigate whether water or any sign of microbial life ever existed on Mars. But first, the rover has to land safely. In a descent that scientists are calling 7 minutes of terror, the probe will pilot itself toward the surface of the red planet, eventually dropping on 6 wheels into the middle of a huge crater. Tropical storm Ernesto is sweeping past Jamaica, but pouring heavy rain on the island. Ernesto is barreling westward and is expected to gain power as it bears down on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. It may be at hurricane strength when it arrives. The National Hurricane Center says Ernesto's reach will extend south to Honduras, which will feel tropical weather effects by late tomorrow. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
Hey, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today has been a frequent guest on the program. He's one of the leading sports writers and probably the leading political sports writer in the country. His name is Dave Zirin. He's the sports editor of The Nation. He also hosts the XM satellite radio show Edge of Sports. And he writes a column, Edge of Sports, which you can find on the web. It's on the Sports Illustrated website. Dave Zirin, welcome back to Media Matters.
Oh, hey, great to be here, Bob.
Well, you know, I recall that we had you on 4 years ago as the Olympics were taking place, too. We've had you on a couple times in between, but it was great having you then because you've written a lot about the history of the Olympics, history of great moments or infamous moments in Olympic history, and the role the Olympics plays politically in the world. So you seem like the ideal person to get back on the air at this time. And just for starters, any preliminary observations on the London Olympics so far?
Well, just that I was there for May, and that was a very good time to be there because I was able to see a lot of the pre-preparations. I was there with Dr. John Carlos, the 1968 Olympian who raised his fist on the medal stand in Mexico City along with Tommy Smith, and that provided me entry into a lot of Olympic facilities, entry into speaking to a lot of Olympic officials, as well as the normal work I would do, which is talk to a lot of people on the street in London about the experience of the Olympics coming in. So I do feel like that gave me a very interesting starting point for understanding what the Olympics mean to a city like London, which, of course, is a very hustling, bustling, Western democracy, as well as a city that is the most surveilled major city in the world before the Olympics, actually has more cameras per capita than any major city in the world. And second, I believe, is Doha, so to give you an idea of things. So the first thing I noticed when I was there, the first thing I noticed when talking to people is that the national security culture, which has been the norm in London since 9/11, has really all out of control. Like you just cannot imagine it unless you're there. The feeling of what it's like to walk the streets of London and see cameras absolutely everywhere. There are more cameras there now than there were a year ago by a huge margin.
Yeah, let me interrupt you on that point, Dave, because it's so important. It's a little less, not exactly where I thought we'd be going, but it's a really great point because I remember they had the demonstrations, protests last year in urban areas in London. And what was striking about it, as I recall, was they could go to all these cameras basically and see the entire thing and slow it down and pick people out. And really it gave you the sense that literally everything you do in a city in that country, someone can see.
And, you know, that process is still going on, actually, of police departments and Scotland Yard going through camera footage from the riots a year ago to pick people out to prosecute.
You know, continue with your point. I just wanted to, because that was such an astonishing revelation.
Yeah, and it's, but that's not all, though. It's what's, well, there's also a gunship in the Thames that's the, of course, the main body of water that flows through the city. There are surface-to-air missiles that are fastened to the roofs of residential apartment buildings. There are surveillance drones flying overhead. Obviously, you can't see them because they are drones, but that was something that was confirmed by Olympic officials. And when I said, ask them if that worries them, the idea of live drones flying overhead, they said, well, they're just surveillance drones. They're not armed drones. And what it really speaks to, the entire security culture there, is honestly, it speaks to like the happy face version of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine thesis. The idea that you have something that's big and strong and powerful and also a tad dangerous, like having the Olympic Games in a city like this. And then that's used as an excuse, as a lubricant, to bring in all sorts of things that the public would otherwise object to if the Olympics weren't, in fact, coming in. And so that was very striking to be there and to see that in action, that kind of Big Brother security culture in a city that already experiences it to a large degree. And people obviously weren't happy about that, particularly there are community meetings when I was there of several hundred on a weekly basis about the presence of surface-to-air missiles on the rooftops of residential apartment buildings. And then, of course, there are the things that are associated with every Olympics that you see in London as well, and that's displacement, gentrification, to go along with the security culture. By displacement, I mean people literally being removed from their homes for the purposes of the Olympic Games, either to build facilities or to provide headquarters for the media. And then there's the powerful corporate culture that takes place when the Olympics are there. And, you know, Adweek has done studies on this that show that companies that associate themselves with the Olympics tend to be looked upon favorably, as favorable, ethical companies. To be associated with the Olympics is like stepping into Lourdes, commercial Lourdes, corporate Lourdes, and stepping out of it as if you were a sin-free corporation. So interestingly, the three main sponsors of the Olympics could arguably be called the three horsemen of the corporate apocalypse. You have British Petroleum, you have Dow Chemical, and you have McDonald's. And their logos and their branding are all over the place in London. And so these were some of the things that I saw firsthand, and they were very striking, and they were very stunning. And it's the reason why, for someone like myself, like I looked with a very jaundiced eye, a very cynical eye, during the opening ceremonies where you saw celebrations of things like the National Health Service, which got a lot of publicity that was part of the opening ceremonies, because I know from being there that they're about to lay off 50,000 people from the National Health Service. David Cameron, the very person clapping for the sort of patriotic display about celebrating the National Health Service at the opening ceremonies of the London Olympics, knowing that I found the thing to be, frankly, more perverse than anything to celebrate because of what's coming down the pike, precisely because of all the money that's being spent on the Olympic Games, as well as the general climate of European austerity.
Our guest today, Dave Zirin, you've just been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We're coming to you live today, August 5th, 2012, here in WILL. The phone lines are open if you have questions or comments for Dave. And the number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455. Our toll-free line is 1-800-222-9455. And Dave Zirin is well-known to many of you. He's written several books, including he co-authored the book with John Carlos, The John Carlos Story, The Sports Moment That Changed the World. Dave's already spoken about that. We're going to talk about that a bit more later. He's written The People's History of Sport in the United States. He's written also the book that we talked about a couple years ago on the show, Bad Sports, about the role of owners in professional sports. It's always a pleasure to have you with us, Dave. Good to have you today. And, you know, this thing about all the advertising and commercialism and cost of the Olympics, who runs the Olympics? Is this a for-profit corporation? Is it accountable to someone? Do they have an elected board of directors? Who gets the right to say that we're setting up the Olympics?
Oh, it's the International Olympic Committee, and they are, it's not even, I think, correct to conceive of them as a corporation or a nonprofit or an NGO. What they really are is like a stateless actor. The IOC actually has non-voting rights, but does have a seat at the United Nations. It actually has a seat at the UN. And what the IOC is able to do when it goes to a different country is it literally establishes sovereignty in that country, not figuratively, but literally.
So it's like a floating Vatican City?
It very much so. Very much so. Like, imagine if Vatican City, if it was Dow Chemical presents Vatican City, and you get an idea of the power of the IOC. I mean, just to give one stray example of that from the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver, that there is a law in the Canadian That's Canada's version of the Constitution. And their law states that you have to provide equal opportunity for men and women. You cannot discriminate against women on the basis of gender, as in the Canadian Constitution. And so people use the Canadian Charter, women athletes, to say women should have the right to be part of the ski jumping competition at the Vancouver Olympics. The IOC said, no, there will be no women who will be doing the ski jump. And they pressed the Canadian government, and the Canadian government actually released this startling statement where they said the Canadian Charter does not have sovereignty in this situation. The IOC does. And for a lot of people, that was like, wow, that's the first time it's ever been stated so clearly, something which we've all known to be the truth. And you've seen that again in these Olympics in 2012 in an incident that I wrote about where an Australian boxer of Aboriginal descent named Damien Hooper, who's a threat to win the light heavyweight gold, he was threatened with being sent home from these Olympic Games because he wore a black T-shirt in the ring with an Aboriginal flag on it, the Aboriginal flag on it, the Indigenous Australian flag. And that flag is actually recognized as an official flag by the country of Australia. It is not the official flag, but is recognized as an official flag of the country. He was threatened with being sent home by the International Olympic Committee. His years of training would have been dashed because the International Olympic Committee does not recognize that flag as an official flag of Australia. And the IOC's rules run the show, including to the point in which the Australian Olympic Committee, instead of defending Damien Hooper, actually called him out on the carpet and issued this embarrassing statement about Hooper's great regret and tears in his eyes and all the rest of it, none of which we know is even confirmed, but basically they humiliated and embarrassed Damien Hooper for the broader purpose of just showing who was the big dog at this particular table, and that it would be the IOC and not, in fact, Damien Hooper.
Our guest today, Dave Zirin, we're talking to him, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Dave, you love sports, obviously, as a fan, as an athlete yourself, amateur athlete, as someone who just enjoys what athletics are all about. Yet you're also quite critical of the way sport is organized in our society. I think anyone who's listened to the show today or read you or heard you in the past gets that. One of the things you like to write about are what sometimes you call political athletes, athletes who have a importance that extends beyond their success on the playing field. And, you know, one of the athletes you've written about recently in that light is Gabby Douglas, the phenomenal gymnast who won the gold medal at the London Olympics. Talk about this notion of political athletes and then a little bit about Gabby Douglas, if you would.
No, absolutely. As I wrote about in my piece about Gabby Douglas, my starting point was just so people wouldn't think I was trying to impose some sort of political representation on Gabby Douglas that she did not want or ask for. Gabby Douglas being the first African-American woman or any person of African descent, for that matter, to win the individual gold in women's gymnastics, as well as the first gymnast, period, to win both the individual and be part of the team gold at the Olympics. I mean, what an incredible accomplishment, especially for a 16-year-old who as recently as a few months ago was described by Marta Caroli, the coordinator of the U.S. women's team, as an average, if not good, gymnast. That was her reputation as of about 6 months ago. So
well, I guess that's rapid improvement.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wouldn't trust the Carolis to house sit a goldfish, let alone describe a female gymnast to me. And frankly, just let me say quickly, like one of the things I found particularly striking about Gabby Douglas is that she was the only female gymnast who didn't look like she was either a hostage or was in some sort of state of horrible mental distress or abuse. I'm not trying to be glib at that at all. People should read a book called Little Girls in Pretty Boxes by Joan Ryan, who is a terrific sports writer, about what young girl gymnasts actually go through and are put through as they go through the paces of being made into an Olympic hero. And I think one of the things that's made Gabby Douglas particularly tough and resilient in this process is that she's had to be tough and resilient. Her story is one that's really about, I mean, if we want to look at it in a way that's actually helpful and evocative, it's really one about segregation in the United States. I mean, this is very little discussed, but we live in a profoundly segregated society, profoundly. And Gabby Douglas is someone who the freight that she had to pay to become an Olympic athlete was to navigate that segregation. She grew up in an African-American community in Virginia Beach, Virginia. I've been to Virginia Beach before. It is an African-American community. Working-class mother, multiple siblings. And she had to travel to West Des Moines, Iowa at the age of 14, leave her family. Her family could not afford to move with her, of course. And she had to live with a host family, a white host family in West Des Moines who she had never met before. She was homeschooled by this family for the next 2 years. While she trained in a sport which, from the United States perspective, is overwhelmingly white, and she navigated all of this, and including at times, actually wondering, as only a teenager would, if she might be in fact the only black person in the state of Iowa, and really wondering that, and obviously issues about music, and all the country music being played, and feeling like nobody really understood her or understood where she was coming from. And she navigated all of this and wasn't beaten down by either the homesickness, the loneliness, the alienation, the segregation, or the racism. Was beaten down by none of it. And that, to me, makes it a political story. And that gets back to your original point, is that I really do believe that there are two kinds of political athletes. There are two categories of political athletes. And I would be very hesitant to say one is, in fact, more important than the other. The first category are the athletes like Muhammad Ali speaking out forcefully against the war in Vietnam, or Billie Jean King marching for Title IX, Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their fists. These are athletes who use the platform of athletics to make explicit political statements. I mean, put Damian Hooper in that category, too, for wearing the Aboriginal flag going into the ring. But then you have the athletes who are political because of what they represent on this high stage. And it can feel unfair sometimes to impose politics on folks who have expressed no desire to embrace politics, and yet that is the role that they play. I mean, whether or not Jack Johnson wanted to be political, the mere fact that he was the first African-American heavyweight champion made him political. Whether or not Martina Navratilova wanted to be political when she played tennis with a power and a muscular just representation that women's athletics had never seen before, that was in fact political just by the sheer fact of her being. You could put the Williams sisters, hell, you could even put Tiger Woods in this category, even though he would be the last person to embrace any kind of political role and actually has been quite the political reactionary indeed. But his representation, his personhood, is political just by the fact of existing. And I think the same thing will happen when we have a male LGBT athlete come out of the closet in one of the major sports. It will be a political act, even if they have no desire to be political. And I think you can put Gabby Douglas in this category as well, very confidently in this category, because she broke barriers. And to have someone like Bob Costas speak about it in a way as if it was like, wow, we've really entered a post-racial America because we're not even discussing the fact that she's black, that's what Bob Costas effectively said after she won her gold, to me is much more about NBC imposing a narrative on the situation as opposed to the reality of what it means in 21st century America. I mean, I would argue racism, structural racism, institutionalized racism continues to be a pernicious force in this country.
Our guest, Dave Zirin, who you've just been listening to, he's a political sports writer, sports editor for The Nation, author of numerous books, including co-author of the John Carlos stories, John Carlos, author of the book Bad Sports, which he spoke about on this show a couple of years ago, A People's History of Sport in the United States. He also has a radio show, Edge of Sports Radio, which can be heard weekly on XM Satellite Radio, and he writes a weekly column. You can find it on the web. Just go Google or enter into search engine Edge of Sports or Dave Zirin. You'll come up with the list of his recent weekly columns and the whole archive. A rich portfolio of material there for anyone who's interested in sports and a critical take on sports. The number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455. Toll free, 1-800-222-9455. There's so much I want to talk about with you, Dave, and I suspect we're going to have some callers who want to come in, too, and issues I want to talk about. And I want to get back to the Olympics later, but I do want to talk about football, because football training camps are opening right now. And it strikes me, and I want to get your take on this, we haven't spoken about this before, that what What's going on with the whole sport of football in general, but particularly in professional and college football, on the issue of concussions and head injuries, is really threatens to the whole existence of the sport in a way nothing has for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just what's your take on that?
You're absolutely, absolutely correct. I mean, this is, first, the starting point for even talking about this is has to be that football is by a large margin the most popular sport in the United States. That's just an objective fact. The most watched television event in the history of this country was the last Super Bowl, and the second most watched is the Super Bowl before that. The NFL is the most popular sport in terms of viewers. The second most popular sport is college football. And its audience, and this is a remarkable thing, just as a cultural phenomenon, Bob, that we have to say, is that its audience in a time of more cable channels, the internet, Facebook, in other words, a more splintered American audience, its audience has actually gotten bigger over the last decade, which is really remarkable. And it's especially remarkable when you think about the fact that football is stubbornly resisted throughout the world. I mean, so much of American culture gets exported with relative ease, from music to Hollywood to basketball as another example. And yet there is stubborn international resistance to embracing the game of American football. And because of that, its market is also very confined and limited to these 50 states. And that means that this concussion issue is huge. It's massive, and it threatens this $9 billion yet projected earnings of $20 to $30 billion a year industry. And I'll tell you one thing that just occurred this past year. Statistics came out that 1 million less parents signed their kids up for football this year than they did the previous year. Now, that works out to about 9% of youth football players. That's actually a huge number when you consider that the sport is actually growing on a year-in, year-out basis. And I think the reason for that is everything that you said. I mean, it's not just the concussions, but it was the suicide of Junior Seau, who played for 20 years in the National Football League and was a future Hall of Famer. The suicide of Dave Duerson, a former NFL player. The suicide of Ray Easterling, who was the lead plaintiff on this class action lawsuit involving head injuries and over 2,000 former NFL players. And just in the last week, we saw the suicide of O.J. Murdoch, who's a wide receiver for the Tennessee Titans. And you have doctor after doctor, talking head after talking head, linking depression and suicidal tendencies to the long-term effect of concussions. And the thing that really worries parents, and the thing that threatens the pipeline of talent and threatens the National Football League, is the realization that it's not the hard hits that create these kinds of concussions and future mental illness and early onset Alzheimer's and dementia. It's not those bang, ESPN jacked up kind of hits. It's just the slow, steady, repetitive hits over the course of a game. And that, the studies show, that applies whether you're talking about the 7 and 8 year olds playing or the NFL. So it's not about force, it's not about speed, it's not about strength, it's about repetition, what are called subconcussive hits. And that's what makes it so dangerous, and that's what makes it so scary, and that's what makes parents so nervous now, and that's what makes, frankly, NFL players. Every time I interview an NFL player, I ask them if they want their kid to play in the NFL. And I'll tell you something, some of them say yes, some of them say no, but these days all of them think about it. All of them actually take the time to think and really be like, gosh, I don't know if I want them to play football, because we know what the cost can be. And I'll just end with this. The thing that also makes football so different from other sports, because of what we know now about the concept of subconcussive hits, the thing that really makes football different is that there is no way to make it safe. I mean, other sports have concussion issues, but football is really the only sport, and I will include boxing in this, and I will include mixed martial arts in this. I would say that football is really the only sport that's kind of like a cigarette. And you could take a cigarette and give it a bigger filter or make it have less tar, but it's still a cigarette, and it's still dangerous, just like football is inherently a dangerous proposition.
So it is not reformable in your view, Dave Zirin.
No, it's not reformable, and that certainly, and I'm not one of the people who thinks that, like, there are people like Malcolm Gladwell who stepped forward and actually talked about the abolition of football, that it should be a prohibition issue. I disagree with that for the same reasons, frankly, I would have disagreed with prohibition in the first place, is that I don't think it's an effective way to actually deal with it. But I do think that it is a sport that is not reformable, and while I am definitely not for prohibition of it, I think the question about whether or not tackle football should be banned as a health risk for example, kids under 14, we're learning more every day about the neurology of that and about the injuries that take place before the brain is developed to the point of being 14 years old. This is real, and it's going to be an ongoing and evolving story as the science develops over in the years ahead.
Here's a crazy idea. What if they just said players couldn't wear helmets?
You know, it's funny you mention that, but I actually think that that would be effective.
Oh, yeah, because rugby, you learn the first time you play it to keep your head out of the mess or you don't play it again.
No, I would actually think that would be effective. I mean, I think that if you go back to the leather helmets of the days of yore, you would be two things would happen. One, it would be the end of players using the helmet, like, you know what they say, like sticking them with the helmet. You would end that whole prospect of the helmet being used as a weapon, which actually is more often than not going to hurt the person using it as a weapon as opposed to the person who's getting hit.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing, and this is just crazy, but wearing the helmet actually increases the risk of brain injury because you're protecting the exterior of your face. So it's like if you got hit really hard in the head and you were bleeding, you'd be taken out of a game. But if a helmet stops the external bleeding, and yet you're bleeding internally, then who's really going to know that? Well, you're going to know that if you have a headache, but if you've been schooled in this hyper-masculine ethos of football that says that to say that you're hurt or that you have a headache or that you have a concussion, then that's equated with weakness, or you could lose your job, then you're going to sit on that and not talk about it. And so the internalizing of the injuries while keeping the external features like normal looking is one of those things that adds to the risk factor of playing football.
Our guest today, Dave Zirin. We're talking about sports here on WILL AM 580. The phone lines at Media Matters are open, 217-333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller who's been waiting patiently. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Dave Zirin.
Yeah, you were talking about political athletes. And I was just watching MSNBC and Jessica Ennis, mm-hmm. and how she won the heptathlon. And in the last race, I think it was an 800 meter, it looked like her competitors kind of were easy on her at first. And just brought up the question, was she... is she really the genuine article? Did she really have a competitive field working against her or not? Since she's British, it seemed possible that, you know, they were letting her glide through. What's your opinion?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think it's less about, I mean, people who work to get to that point, they're not going to let anybody win. Well, unless they're badminton players and there's a incentive built in to let their opponent win, but that was more a quirk of how the International Olympic Committee organized badminton. But in that particular case, you got to keep in mind that that was the heptathlon, and so it's an accumulation of scores. And so she really only needed, she did not even need to do very well in that 800 meters, and she still would have won the heptathlon. The person who was second in that race, I believe, would have had to beat her by 12 full seconds, which just would not have happened. For the person who was running second to win the heptathlon. And so I think you may have seen at the end a bit of pulling up to give her the ceremonial first-place finish because she had so, like, profoundly outpaced the competition. But I think that's about as far as it would go.
Yeah, thank you very much, caller. You know, let's talk a little bit, if we can, about the John Carlos, who you wrote the book with and you've traveled with and know well. I think I have some listeners who probably are vaguely familiar with what happened in 1968 and its significance. Some who know a lot about it, and some who probably don't even know about it at all. So maybe you could just recount what the 1968 Olympics were like, the environment, and what John Carlos and Tommy Smith did.
Well, sure. I mean, the first thing I would just say is that A lot of people know the moment, but they may not know the movement. People know the moment. People have seen it in history books. People have seen it on T-shirts or posters. The image of Tommy Smith and John Carlos defiantly raising their black fists to the heavens, wearing a black glove in the 1968 Olympics. But a lot of people who I've encountered and who John has encountered really see the moment abstracted from a movement, and see it as just sort of an abstract, general call to arms, or like this was 1968, and you know, there was all these protests in the streets, and that was just a symbol of the movements that were roiling outside the athletic arena. And that's certainly true. Obviously, that influenced why they did what they did. But they did what they did because, very concretely, they were part of something called the Olympic Project for Human Rights that really stood on a set of principles that were very connected to the worlds of sports and politics. Like, they wanted to see Muhammad Ali's title restored. His title, of course, had been taken away because of his opposition to the war in Vietnam. They wanted to see South Africa and Rhodesia, which were both apartheid countries, permanently excluded from the Olympic Games. They wanted to see more African-American coaches hired. At the time, there was only one assistant coach in all of the U.S. Track and field. And lastly, this was the one that was really the most dangerous for them to take up, is they wanted Avery Brundage to be kicked out of his perch as head of the International Olympic Committee. I mean, this would have been the equivalent in 1968 of people saying, we want J. Edgar Hoover removed from the head of the FBI. I mean, it was a very daring move against an all-powerful person who figuratively knew where all the bodies were buried. And by doing that, and by calling out the history of Avery Brundage as somebody who has a history of white supremacist and Hitler sympathies, who was responsible for delivering the 1936 Olympics to Hitler's Germany, that was very daring. And then the last thing, which was just very daring in general, is if you look at the statements that they were making, is they were, this is very dangerous. I mean, you can imagine if, even in today, in 2012, imagine if Gabby Douglas did something like this. They said that they didn't like the fact that their Olympic success would be used at the Olympics in front of an international audience to export a lie about the United States, that somehow the United States was a place that was not – they didn't use the phrase post-racial because the phrase didn't exist at the time, but that's effectively what they were saying. They said, like, as if racism was something in the past. And, you know, people say, oh, wow, well, these guys won gold. That means there must be opportunity for all African Americans, equal opportunity in the United States. Now, imagine if Gabby Douglas said something like people might think that we're in a post-racial world because Obama's president and I won a gold. Well, guess what? There's somebody named Trayvon Martin out there who tells a different story. You know, imagine if that had happened. Imagine what Fox News was criticizing Gabby Douglas over the weekend because she wasn't wearing the red, white, and blue festooned gymnastics outfit. You know, so it's like people are kind of nuts in general when it comes to talking about racism and bigotry in this country. And these guys did it on the biggest possible stage. And I think the reason why it resonates so strongly to this day is precisely because, A, it was incredibly daring, and, B, they were on the right side of history. I mean, who the heck now is going to say, no, South Africa and Rhodesia deserve their seat at the table? Avery Brundage was a great person. So they really were ahead of their time in terms of the issues they were trying to bring to light.
You know, back in the 1960s, and you've written about this, you've written about Muhammad Ali at length, but back in the 1960s, there was sort of a famous summit in Cleveland, Ohio, to support Muhammad Ali when he was facing criminal charges from the government for refusing to go into the military. And at that summit were Jim Brown of the Cleveland Browns and Bill Russell of the Boston Celtics, unquestionably at that time the two best athletes in the world in their respective sports. Some would argue still to this day remain that honor. But they came out forcefully in Muhammad Ali's support. And, you know, it's so unusual in American sports history. Has there ever been anything like that before or since?
Wow. Well, it's really interesting because I don't think there's been anything like Muhammad Ali, period, before or since.
But even Jim Brown and Bill Russell, what they did in that same period.
Yeah, it was definitely, you had this thing known as the Revolt of the Black Athlete, which you still have political athletes, but I think what made the late 60s so different is, as you said, these are also the best athletes in their sport. So while today I could point out political basketball players to you or political football players, players who say political things, who do political things, the idea that you have the people who are the best of the best doing it. Remember, Lou Alcindor was at that same conference that you're referring to,
mm-hmm.
who was without question the best college basketball player. You could argue to ever live, the best college basketball player. So, I mean, just a remarkable confluence of skill and platform and politics all coming together at the same time in the late 1960s. And, of course, not a coincidence that they were riding the crest and confidence of a black freedom struggle that was taking place. Very interesting, like this past year, like the fact that the Miami Heat all stood together with their hoodies on in protest of what had happened to Trayvon Martin. And the fact that George Zimmerman still at that time had not been arrested for his shooting. But they didn't do it by accident. I mean, there were something like 40 walkouts of South Florida high schools alone. So you had, it's like knowing where the cart is and knowing where the horse is very important. And I think that you could see something like that again, but it would take, a real seismic period of struggle in social movements to see that happen.
Yeah, our guest today, Dave Zirin, the sports writer, joining us for the full hour. If you have any questions, feel free to call in at 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL. We've got about 20 minutes left, time for callers, if someone wants to call in, and lots of stuff to talk about. Barely scratched the surface of what I wanted to get at. And one issue that you've written about a lot, Dave, that's been in the news, of course, has been the Penn State Jerry Sandusky scandal. And you've written about that also in the context, I think, of just the general corruption of college sports and the exploitation of college athletes. So, give me your take on the penalties against Penn State and sort of the state of major college sports.
Oh, I mean, I think it's an absolute sewer at this point. And I think the thing about Penn State, which is so jarring, is that you really do see just how low the floor is, because there's always been this question about, wow, what would a big-time football program be willing to cover up for the purposes of protecting the Golden Goose, for purposes of protecting its brand, and for purpose of protecting just the flow of not just money from the football program, but image and endorsements and television contracts? What really would they be willing to abide? And we've seen the willingness to abide hookers. We've seen the willingness to abide hooking up players with all kinds of drugs and jewelry and money and all the rest of it. And at Penn State, you see the most respected coach in the history of the sport being willing to abide a serial child predator. And that's really jarring, because it just shows you just how deep and nasty the abyss actually is of what is the gutter economy of college sports, and how incredibly twisted revenue-producing sports have become on the landscape. Now, I'm somebody who opposed strongly the NCAA's recent sanctions on Penn State, because honestly, I think the problem starts with the NCAA. And when they're allowed to actually ride in on the white horse and act like they are the defenders of the morality of a system that's utterly amoral and that keeps creating these kinds of scandals, then all you're doing is ensuring more scandals to come. So when you have a situation like this where, to me, you look at Penn State, and clearly this is a situation for the civil and criminal courts. I mean, if people in power were covering up child abuse and child rape, then they should be held to account and they should be sent away, and people should sue that school for every cent they can get. But when you have a situation of the NCAA, which is a private entity, a nonprofit with a president who makes $1.6 million a year and has 14 vice presidents, each of whom make at least $400,000 a year, and they are entering a public institution like Penn State and taking $60 million out of this public institution, then I think you're dealing with something that's frankly very frightening and very reminiscent. We talked about this earlier with regards to the Olympics, but it's once again reminiscent to this idea of the shock doctrine, where you take something so horrific like the Jerry Sandusky scandal and you're able to then manipulate that and use it in a way that's profoundly undemocratic, because people's minds are still spinning and there's this thirst for justice no matter what guise it takes. and it's a very scary set of circumstances. And so it's my position. I think some people have had some problems with it as I've been publicizing it, but I mean, there's no book big enough that can be thrown at Penn State, but at the same time, the NCAA is not the body that should be codified with the ability to do that.
Our guest today is Ira. We have a bank of people wanting to ask you questions or make comments. And before I get to them, I want to finish up this discussion of major college sports, a very important issue clearly at the University of Illinois, as it is at many large campuses in the country and smaller ones too. You wrote a column very critical of college sports, big time college sports, not too long ago. And you talked about Urban Meyer, the football coach now at Ohio State, getting, I believe, a $4 million a year contract or something. And you contrasted it, and it was very jarring when I read it, to the legendary Ohio State football coach from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, Woody Hayes, probably the Joe Paterno of his era in terms of being the most recognized college football coach in the nation. And his peak salary was $40,000 a year in the late 70s before he retired. And, you know, 1% or so, 0.1% of what Urban Meyer's making. What does that say about college sports, and do they even belong on campus? The question should be asked.
It talks about how, I mean, that's the thing that's so upsetting about it to me is, like, look, you can go back 100 years and find W.E.B. Du Bois writing about his concerns about the corrosive role of big-time sports on a college campus. So this concern is nothing new. But at the same time, over the last 40 years, there has been a profound, profound change in the power relationship between these revenue-producing sports and the college campus that's exemplified in the comparative salaries of a Woody Hayes and an Urban Meyer. I mean, the amount of money that it brings in, the amount of money in terms of fundraising that a big-time coach can provide, the fact that at most state schools, the football coach, sometimes the basketball coach, but more often than not the men's football coach, is going to be the highest-paid public employee in the state. I mean, I go back to what Gordon Gee, who's the president of Ohio State, what he said when they had their scandal there. He was asked if he's going to fire Jim Tressel, and he said, I should just hope that Jim Tressel doesn't fire me. So everything is so out of whack on these campuses, and yet the one thing that hasn't changed, you know, the stadiums are now massively bigger, the TV contracts are hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, the coaches have gone from $40,000 to $4 million a year, the size of the staff is so massive, it's ridiculous. But the thing that's really, the only thing that stayed the same through all of this is that we still have this concept of the student athlete and the player who isn't paid. And that, to me, is the root of all evil of everything that we're talking about. If the players were just made, it's too big to fail and too big to derail. And so while I want to see the NFL have its own minor league, that's probably unrealistic. But as long as you have college football players who aren't paid like the campus employees that they are, and let's face it, that's what they are. They are campus employees. As long as they're not paid, you have a recipe for scandal, because what you have instead is the setup of a gutter economy. So why does a player choose the school that they go to? Well, maybe it's because they know at one school they can get out of taking classes. Maybe at another school they're promised sex. Maybe at another school they're promised money under the table. Maybe at another school they're promised strippers. Maybe at another school they're promised carte blanche to party as hard as they want. Maybe at another school they're promised a toboggan ride to the NFL and a way to take steroids in a way that boosts their prospects. You see, so everything operates below board, and none of the players feel any hesitation about flouting these rules for the simple reason that the whole system is so hypocritical. Why should they feel any moral compunction whatsoever when you so clearly have a system that's set up to exploit them within an inch of their lives? That's why in one column I said, like players are like this uneasy combination of campus gods and chattel at the same time. It's like this dual campus existence of being an indentured servant but also being on this pedestal that's ridiculous for any student to be on. And I think the only way to get them off that pedestal, the only way to make the system sane, is to regulate it, codify it, pay them a fair wage based on the revenue that's produced. And until you do that, you're going to keep having these scandals. And it's not to say that there wouldn't be scandal without this, but at least in this case, you have a mechanism and a basis for enforcement of law instead of what you have now.
Our guest Dave Zirin. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We have three callers who've waited patiently. Let's end the show by letting each of them get a chance to make their question or comment. Let's start with line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Dave Zirin.
Hi. Discussing athletic safety, I think the most dangerous incident that can occur is in mixed martial arts when an opponent gets knocked down and he's laying flat on his back. Unlike boxing, where if a person takes a direct, straight jab, his head will rock back, and that will absorb some of his some of the blow. But a person that gets knocked down in mixed martial arts, he can be laying flat on the canvas. The opponent can jump on him, and if he delivers a straight blow, his head has got no place to go. If it's a hook, yeah, it can swivel, but his head has no place to go if he gets a direct blow. And I'm just afraid that somebody's going to get killed in that process.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Dave Zirin?
I think you could make a strong case that mixed martial arts is far safer than boxing or football or even hockey. Because one of the things about mixed martial arts is that direct blows to the head are stopped almost immediately. And you're not wearing gloves. So there's only so hard you can punch with a bare fist, because your hand contains a lot of very small, very tiny, very delicate bones. I mean, only in the movies do you hit someone in the face repeatedly without breaking your hand. And that's actually, it's like what we were talking about before, Bob, with the helmets.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, conversely, boxing would actually be much safer if they went to bare-knuckled boxing. I mean, it would be more disgusting, without question, but there would also be far less of the kind of repetitive blows. I mean, people would be much more mangled facially as well. But in some ways, at least that's more honest.
Yeah.
Because it's like you don't see the blows on the face as much when you're hit with a big flat glove. But your brain, like a piece of gefilte fish inside the jar, just keeps sloshing back and forth against your skull. And that, believe me, when you're 55 years old, you'd much rather have a broken nose and cauliflower ears than you'd want to have the kind of brain that gets repeatedly smashed against the side of your skull.
So I take it, Desiree, you wouldn't let your children play football.
You know what? I'll tell you this because it's very interesting. My father-in-law, my wife's father, was drafted by the Dallas Cowboys, and in the last year, he has gone from saying, absolutely, my grandson needs to play football, to saying, please don't let him play football. So it's not even about what I would allow. It's like the right-wing football-loving edge of my family tree has stepped forward to say, yeah, you remember all that pressure I was giving you about him playing? Well, let's try to find something else.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line three, Urbana, you're on the air with Dave Zirin.
Given that the host nation at the Olympics, as often as not, fails to profit from the Olympics, in fact, usually loses money, that the siting of the venue is normally a low-income neighborhood, which is bulldozed, and when the Olympics are finished, it's replaced with a high-rise luxury apartment complex, leaving the original residents out in the cold. Why don't the powers that be select a permanent site? I would suggest Greece, the original home of the Olympics, and just leave it there. It would eliminate rebuilding every 4 years. There would no longer be the insane bidding for the Olympics by cities and countries, and it...
Well, that's a great question, caller. Let's let Dave Zirin answer that. Dave?
You're preaching to the choir on that one. That's a revenue that I've been putting forward for several years. That I think that when you look at the ways that a lot of these Olympic facilities have no use value once they're built, then you create a situation where it would really make a lot of sense to have a permanent site for the Games. And the fact that Greece, since it's had its austerity crisis, a lot of its Olympic facilities have become de facto squatter communities. With homeless people living inside them, so the recently homeless, to be clear about that. And so it would make a lot more sense. The problem is that the Olympics are just a one percenter paradise. I mean, it is a neoliberal Trojan horse that allows for the kind of wholesale gentrification that, like I said at the beginning, people would oppose otherwise if they had half a chance. But when it comes in the guise of the Olympics and the guise of what the writer Jules Boykoff called celebration capitalism, it becomes a lot easier to push through. So that's the reason why there won't be a permanent site, because there are too many world leaders bidding for the right to do it and too many corporations that want to be a part of it. When it goes to new markets, like in China, for example, where it was a huge opportunity for market penetration by corporations that hadn't been able to get in before. But what you're talking about is a way that we could have the Olympics and also lessen the disruption and the pain that, actually is engendered on ordinary people's lives when the Olympics come to town. And I would support it with bells on, although that is just a saying.
Let's go to our final caller now for the day, Line 4, Peoria. You're on the air with Dave Zirin.
Hello. Talking about John Carlos and Tommy Smith, I remember those days. And I wondered whatever happened to Dr. Harry Edwards, who was their mentor.
Well, I was just on the phone with Dr. Edwards a week ago, so I'm well equipped to tell you that. He is retired, but he is a professor emeritus at Cal Berkeley. He does speaking engagements and consulting throughout the world. He has a tremendous place of esteem as really being the founder of modern sports sociology, which is now a discipline that has its own department, or at the very least is part of departments like history or kinesiology at schools around the country, actually around the world, really. And so Dr. Harry Edwards is doing really, really well and is recognized for the fact that he was really ahead of the pack in terms of seeing how important sports was as a lens for understanding the broader world.
One of the criticisms of sports in the United States, and probably everywhere elsewhere, but certainly in the United States, maybe peculiarly in the United States, Dave Zirin, is, you know, Americans are obsessed with sports. They follow sports. It's this huge deal. And it also is a society that is less politically oriented, that people substitute concern for politics with an obsession with following sports and sports leagues and sports teams. I suspect you've heard this before. I'd like your response.
Well, there are certainly people who say that sports is an opiate of the masses in a lot of ways, the way religion was at one point. And for people who say that, my first response is always to say, and your problem with opium is what now? Because, you know, life is tough. And frankly, I see nothing wrong with the fact that people look for means to escape. It's hard to think of something that would be more human than people after a very tough and dehumanizing day trying to find something with which to relax with. But the other thing that I would say to that is that I think that people really do miss the boat if they think that when fans are involved with sports, they're not doing something political. Because there's so much politics in sports. There's so much political engagement that happens through the language of sports, that there is a real opportunity to engage people on more substantive political issues through sports, whether you're talking about the issue, Bob, that you've written about a great deal, which is the public funding of stadiums, or whether you're talking about the role of racism or homophobia or sexism in sports. I mean, we just passed the 40th anniversary of Title IX. I mean, there are so many rich opportunities to talk about politics through sports. Heck, just recently, you had a member of the Palestinian national soccer team released from an Israeli prison where he was engaged in a hunger strike, and it really was the solidarity of FIFA, of all things, the international soccer body, which got Israel to release him. He'd been held without charges for almost 3 years. So these are things that are political acts.
Dave Zirin, I hear the band tuning up the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. One quick question before we go. If you could only watch one sport for the rest of your life, which would it be?
For the rest of my life, it would be the beautiful game, the real beautiful game, and that would be basketball. Men's, women's, don't care. Just love the game of hoop.
You and I are on the same page, brother. Dave Zirin, my guest today in Media Matters, it's a pleasure as always to have you, Dave. Keep up the great work. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Christina Williams, my wonderful producer, Kyle Croho, my engineer, and everyone at WILL for their support. Be back in 167 hours. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Partly sunny this morning, a slight chance of showers, then sunny skies this afternoon, the high 88 degrees. Cooler and clear tonight with a low of 58. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 85. Monday night and Tuesday, mostly clear with a low of 62 degrees. The high 88, mostly clear Tuesday evening.